Good evening. Welcome to The Point with Ed Mullins. I am Pete Panuccio, retired sergeant, filling in for Ed tonight. Our guest tonight is retired sergeant Chris Strom. Good evening, Chris.
Hey, good evening, Pete. How are you?
All right. How you been?
Good. Surviving.
We all are. So, Chris, you're here tonight. We want to pick your brain a little bit. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background in the job.
Sure. 20 years with the NYPD patrol, anti-crime, got into a shooting. So they transferred me to a robbery unit. Did that for 4 years. I loved it. Got promoted to sergeant, shifted out of Queens into Brooklyn, ran this new team. Post 9/11, I got drafted and recruited actually into the intelligence division and worked with some amazing people, super smart people, and finished out my career there the last 5 years of my career.
Tell us a little bit about the kind of work you were doing in the intel division.
Well, sure. I started out as a field intelligence officer in the 7-6 precinct, and there was a need for it. Obviously, we were a little bit behind the curve post 9/11. And then what happened was I was making some bones and some good cases and things like that, and I got picked up and put into what they call the leads desk. So essentially, any kind of counterterrorism notification, email, phone call, anonymous letter that came in through the JTTF, I responded to. So as an example, some of the things were pretty mundane, suspicious activity. People were very hypersensitive about Middle Eastern folks and things like that. And, unlike a lot of other police departments and maybe some other agencies, I know you know this, but for your audience benefit, we actually left the office and did some door knocks and talked to people. And we actually did real interviews with real live people. We didn't get our information solely from the internet. And so that was one aspect of it. The other aspect was actually live responses. So typically, if there was an explosion or a suspicious package in front of a sensitive location, it could be a courthouse, a post office, a U.S. attorney's office, something like that. And we would respond live and to it as in progress. And, again, there's a lot of competing entities that wanted to get there first, to include the news media. And, I worked for a gentleman by the name of David Cohen, who was a 36-year CIA guy. And he was a very serious guy and a very smart guy. And he didn't want to hear about what was transpiring from the news media. He wanted to hear from you. At the actual scene. And, I know you know this because you've been a cop for over 40 years in New York City. Sometimes getting from point A to point B is the most difficult part of the job because of the way traffic is, the construction, time of day, events, other events that may or may not be going on in the city. So that was a challenge, but it was a challenge that I really enjoyed doing. And I worked, again, as I say, with some really amazing people that made a big difference in the city in terms of keeping it safe from terrorist activity.
I think one of the things is that I spent most of my career either on patrol in the detective bureau, and at times we would come across things we'd have to call intel or JTTF and refer to them. But like everything else, you do your initial bit, you pass it off, and then you never hear about it again. And so a lot of people, including people in the job, really just don't have a very clear idea of what goes on at intel. You see them at the events, in dignitary protection when the UN is in town, but they don't realize there's a whole big picture that's going on 365 days a year, 24/7.
Absolutely.
You talk about getting around in Manhattan. That's why I spent That's why I spent my last 10 years in night watch. One less aggravating thing to deal with was with traffic. But like you said, we would get out of the blue, you would just get some wacky phone call and you're like, I don't know if this is real but we would go out and I would find myself standing there. I says, I think we need to call somebody that's a little bit more up on the subject than me. These calls come in all the time. I don't think people realize the amount of, I'm not saying this to scare anybody either, but the amount of suspicious devices that turn up, different kind of threats that are picked up. It's real. It's out there. And it's, you often don't get enough, or the NYPD doesn't often get enough credit for the amount of work that they do, because you just don't hear about it. Yeah, the media, that's a conversation we could go on. We could do a whole nother show about the race. So tell us what happened after you retired and about your Brooklyn to Baghdad adventures. For the listening audience, people, look this book up, buy this book, Brooklyn to Baghdad. It's one of our own. And it tells an incredible story of what Chris did after he retired.
Yeah, sure. You know, I retired and, you know, like I said, I worked with some great people. I got the gold ring. I got the plaque. I mean, I really love these people. And we were really like a family. And I relocated to Roanoke, Virginia. And I thought, well, you know, I'm just going to do something different, change the direction of my life. And I got involved in a construction company. And that lasted for about 7 or 8 months. And the relationship deteriorated. And, you know, he had one way of working and I had another way of working. And we didn't see eye to eye. So we parted ways. And now I find myself unemployed. And I had started applying for jobs that, you know, were law enforcement related. And the other part that was really going on is the war in Iraq was every day. And you would see images of soldiers being killed and things like that. And it was very frustrating and disheartening. And I served 4 years in the Marine Corps, so I had a special affinity for these people. So I applied for this one job, and I get called by a recruiter. And he describes the job to me. He says, you know, you'd be basically going over as a contractor, but you'd be in a working group, and you'd be helping, like, the base commander look at the problems as if it's like a criminal enterprise. And he said, is that something you'd be interested in? I said, I'm definitely interested. So fast forward, I go to the onboarding and there's like a 3-week orientation, you know, we're PowerPointing to death and doing physical training and things like that. And they call myself and two other people out of the main body of the class. So it's probably about 35, 40 people in there. And I get in with the program manager. He goes, relax, relax. You guys aren't in trouble. We just want to run something by you. So, the mission was essentially the same, going to Iraq, a one-year commitment. But now, basically, my assignment is going to be part of a team of I'll be embedded with a team of special forces operators who are also retired. And my main function is going to be interrogation at the point of capture of al-Qaeda and insurgent fighters in southern Baghdad.
Wow. Quite the adventure, I have to say.
Yes, it was pretty exciting and pretty scary at moments. I have to be honest with you on that as well.
You know, I think a lot of times with terrorists, insurgents, you know, they have different objectives, but a lot of times to deal with these people, you're also dealing with the criminal element. That's how they fund themselves. They're scales, let's face it. It's a little bit more different focus on what they're doing, but in a lot of ways, you know, you're tracking people the same way you would in a major case in New York City.
Absolutely.
Instead of a robbery team or a guy doing homicides, you know, you're looking for somebody 8,000 miles away that's trying to kill Americans. So Tell us about your year there. Tell us.
Well, the team I worked with was amazing. Again, I'm blessed to be surrounded by super smart people, people that are very motivated, people that are very committed. Let's face it. I mean, like I said, you know, I have a special affinity for these people. I love the soldiers. I did 4 years in the Marine Corps. And I think military people and law enforcement in general are the finest people in the world. Not that I think that. I know that, having been in both uniforms. The team that I worked with, you know, everybody had their own part to play. Mine just happened to be interrogation. But, you know, we had people there that were intel analysts from the military side. We had linguists. We had canine people. We had explosive ordnance detection people. So, I mean, everybody played a part. And the team initially went through several iterations. And what I mean by that, the original people I did a 3-month train up with, they were there for about 6 months and they left. And then they brought on new people. And thank God they did, because the first team that we had, the guy that was running the team was really, he was horrible. He had no communication skills. He ruled by, you know, fear and intimidation and just yelled at people. And he'd get in the room, and I'll just give you an example. We're in there having a briefing, and the JAG is in there. So, you know, the military is very adverse to risk with their own people. Now infuse some, you know, retired 40-some-odd-year-old, I'm 48 years old, civilians in this role, and you're trying to gain buy-in with these folks. And so at one point at the end of the meeting, the guy that was running the team says something to the effect, you know, and in addition to all the great things that we could do for you, all my guys double as shooters. So the JAG officers, there's two of them there at this particular time. And for what people don't know, if they don't know what a JAG officer is, he's the judge advocate. He's the lawyer that advises the colonel. And he is there to mitigate any kind of risk. Well, after that one sentence phrase about how we all double as shooters, we didn't work for about a month and a half. So I'm just trying to be honest about how things work. Fast forward, we got a new team lead, and the guy's name was Adoni Paletica. I'm still very close with him to this day, and his communication skills were off the chart. Very mature, very soft-spoken, very deliberate, and he got us buy-in with this one particular team called 122 TSC, which stands for Tactical Strike Team. And once that relationship developed and that level of trust and working together in synchronicity, I mean, we crushed these people. We literally crushed them.
I think it's something that a lot of people don't realize, don't understand. A very good friend of mine from the Upper East Side, his father was on the NYPD. He was going to come on the job. He got accepted into Georgetown, Georgetown Law. And he's like, but I want to be, I says, forget being a cop. Go to Georgetown. Get that, you know, get that piece of paper first. Juris Doctor from Georgetown, because it's you're really writing your ticket for life, for what you want to do. He left Georgetown. After not, he completed his degree. Still talking about coming on the job. And he winds up enlisting in the Army. And wow. They scoffed him right up. And he becomes a JAG. He wanted to become a warfighter. He wanted to be out there. You know, he's sitting there. Finally, they send him to Iraq. And I'm not going to go further into which unit he was with, but he was with a special ops team. And we would, every now and then, we'd talk or shoot emails back and forth. And you think about it, people don't realize is that you're sending out special ops teams, but they have to have an attorney go with them. I don't think General Patton, as he was storming through Germany, you know, had JAG guys there. Well, wait a minute. You can attack that house or you can shoot that tank, but leave that one alone, you know, just to simplify it. But a strange way to fight a war with your lawyer out there. Everything had to be vetted. For me, as a guy, you know, I survived the Trade Center on 9/11, both tower collapses. And too old to go out there and enlist or whatever, but you start questioning, you start saying, how are we prosecuting this war? You know, we need to loosen up on the rules of engagement. I understand the rules are there. You don't want to kill civilians or hurt people. But by the same token, you also need to be able to fully capitalize and hit them hard. Just mind-boggling to me, just my observation on it. So you did a full year. Mostly in Baghdad, in that area, or did you go into the outskirts? Or
I stayed in southern Baghdad. I actually did 15 months altogether. But yeah, pretty much in southern Baghdad. I'm not going to give this specific.
Yeah, location. Yeah, no, don't.
But yeah, southern Baghdad. And to give some context, our base was Fob Falcon, so we're about 11 or 12 miles south of Victory Base in Baghdad International Airport. So that if somebody looked on the map, you could kind of like see where we were in relation to Baghdad. And that's where the majority of the problems were. That's where the majority of the IEDs and EFPs were occurring. That also happened to be, unfortunately, the primary killer of our soldiers and kids over there.
Now, in regards to IEDs, we've heard a lot of news, you know, news talk about it over the years. And were the IEDs coming from Iran?
100%. Let me clarify that. There's two different types of explosive devices. So I don't want to conflate the two. One is an IED, which stands for improvised explosive device. Now, many of the roadside bombs that were being built in Iraq were being built by actually university-degreed engineers that came to America. They learned electrical engineering, and they knew how to do a bomb that, that they could detonate either remotely through a cell phone, a wire, or infrared, or any number of different ways. The EFP, which stands for explosive form projectile or penetrator, depending on the school of thought, those were directly shipped in from Iran. In both cases, whether it was the IED or the EFP, the financing and the material support was coming from Iran to build these bombs, to back the insurgency, to back Al-Qaeda fighters.
I find that, you know, incredibly infuriating, for the lack of a better term. At that time, was the insurgency was still going on, and had they started the surge yet?
The surge kicked off in, I believe it was January of 2007, and I got boots on the ground in February 2008. So the surge had already started before I got there, and the methodology and the way they were prosecuting the war was starting to change. But, you know, they had this expression called left of boom, meaning that you want to find the device before the bomb goes off. And the Army was trying to do that. I'm just using the Army. I'm sure the Marine Corps and other other branches of the military were doing it. But they were using all this Gucci gear, electronic gizmo stuff to try and find it. And at the end of the day, if you found 50 bombs, did you find the bomb maker? No. Did you find the person that financed it or housed this guy or supplied the materials to put the bomb together? No. So the whole genius of this program, which was actually a concept that had never been done before in terms of the composite of the team, clearly certain elements of what was going on in the war were being done, but it wasn't all holistic in one self-contained unit to go out and prosecute the war. And like I said, once this team got up and running, once we got buy-in from other what we call greensuiters, regular Army people, I mean, we crushed these people. I did over 110 combat missions. The team collectively, not just me, the team collectively rounded up 91 high-value targets, Tier 1 and Tier 2. So, again, for your audience, those are the same targets that Delta and SEAL teams go after. That's how effective the team was. The team, not me, the team.
What would happen with the high-value targets? I mean, if you can speak to it. If you can't, I understand. I mean, but
That's a great question.
Where would they go? Where would they wind up?
Well, you know, I would do my bit in terms of interrogation. And then what would happen is we would bring them back to either my base, or we would bring them to another base where they had a bigger holding facility for these detainees, these murderers, these terrorists. A lot of times what would happen would be almost like in the police department. When you make a certain collar and somebody's flagged in the system, it triggers something in the computer database. So many times we would come back to my base, which was Fob Falcon, and we would put this person in the cell, and I'd be walking literally from the jail cell area in terms of where the jail cell area, everything was kind of linear. So I'd walk from the jail cell past my workshop on my way to maybe get something to eat or get a cup of coffee. And in between me was the helipad, and who's coming in for a landing? The Special Forces team that was looking for this guy 6 months ago. So it's kind of like, you know, like when the, you know, a cop on patrol makes a very, very big narcotics collar. I just say that. Or maybe the guy was wanted on, had a wanted card for a homicide. You know, the cop doesn't know that initially. He just knows that the guy is either driving drunk or he was in a stolen car, whatever it might be. But all these mechanisms are built into the military as well, similarly so. A lot of times that would happen. Now, where they went after that, I'm not really sure. I'm not going to speak to that because I don't really know.
Yeah, that's like, you know, you grab a guy on the street with a gun. Okay, you got a gun collar. And then 2 days later, you see him being led into central booking, being charged with 5 homicides. And, you know, squad gets the glory. you know, but it was the man on the street paying attention.
Absolutely.
That saw that perp, saw that gun. He's the guy that has the interaction, usually sometimes one-on-one or you and your partner with a bad dude. But then next thing you know, whoosh, in come the, you know, the troops. And yeah, okay, kid, we got it from here.
I was just going to say that, but you beat me to it. Like the old, hey, you know, hey, buddy, thanks a lot. The old pat on the back. We appreciate it. Listen, at the end of the day, whether it was the police department or the military, the greater good was served. The guy is got. He's done. You know what I mean? So that, you know, check the box. Whoever's checking, it doesn't really matter. It's great.
Yeah. Feather in your cap, kid.
Yes,
good
sir.
Good job.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So now these people, I as we've seen what's gone on in the last couple of weeks with Afghanistan, I'm assuming maybe the same in Iraq. A lot of these people will eventually put back into circulation at some point. They might have did a few years in the pokey and, okay, all is well. You know, new government, we're going to give amnesty, you know, whatever president is in office that day. We saw what was going on with the Taliban as they were tearing through Afghanistan and opening up the prisons and letting the ISIS guys out. You know, I think we all know the Taliban is a group of people. They basically suck. If you want to get even suckier, start looking at ISIS. ISIS formed out of a void, really, in 2014 after we really kind of pulled out of Iraq. And our former president at the time described it as the JV team. Well, they were anything but a JV team. And I think to the point where probably a lot more vicious. You know, you had some winners running around in Iraq at the time with Zarqawi, you know, cutting people's heads off. And then you get ISIS. Like, and I'm a student of history. I'm a history buff, particularly military history. And I remember reading in the paper or seeing it wherever, Fallujah got taken over. I'm like, Fallujah? How many Marines, military personnel, did we lose fighting Fallujah? I think not once, but twice. A lot of American blood was lost in that dump of a city.
Yep.
And you leave a void, and what happens? The new kids on the block, the JV team comes in there, and I'm like, is nobody even upset about this? The media, the president? I mean, like, how can you, a major battle 10 years before, we fought a couple of major battles in there. Hundreds of Marines killed, and not even a blip on the radar. And then after that, ISIS, you know, was on a roll throughout the Middle East. And I have a feeling we might be seeing them again. I guess the ISIS folk were your time there predated it a little bit, or did some of those guys you were going after, did they eventually become the core of ISIS?
You know, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe what you just said is correct. I believe that Al-Qaeda became franchised into ISIS. And I think so you would have what they call AQI, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So, but I think to your point, I believe the Al-Qaeda folks actually became ISIS folks as well. Again, the financing was coming from Iran. You know, just as a bit of history for Iraq, while I was there, certain cities were off limits. One of them was Sadr City. And there was a fellow by the name of Muqtada al-Sadr, whose father was a Shiite cleric and a real, like, son of a gun. And his son inherited basically his position after the father passed. So the terrorists would do their dirty deeds, kill the soldiers, and they would run into Sadr City. Now, we knew that, and I'm not going to get too technical about how we knew that, but we knew that. And then we would want to action a target in Sadr City. I mean, now, keep in mind, okay, there was an attack, and I'm just using this as a generality, on soldiers, and they were killed. Some were murdered, maimed. Some were killed. Some were lost their limbs, whatever. And the target is identifiable, and he's in Sadr City, sitting there. We know this. You're not going. It's off limits. So getting back to what you were saying before about rules of engagement, the insanity and the layering of minutia, and, you know, you can shoot a guy if there's a perceived threat. You can shoot a guy if you see a weapon. You can't shoot a guy if he's in a crowd of five people. I mean, like, the rules of engagement, the what they call the status of forces agreement, which changed the whole dynamic of the battlefield, is anybody's guess. And it's, you know, it's almost impossible between that and your friend the JAG, you know, to prosecute a war. I mean, it's so heavily laden with rules that, you know, this poor 19-year-old kid is getting out there. And not only is he afraid for himself and his brothers and sisters, but he's afraid that he's going to make a mistake. And that's not fair to the soldier. It's not fair.
Also very similar to cops today on patrol in New York City. It's not that they're not brave, courageous, and they want to fight. They worry. The first thing going through their minds, am I going to get jammed up? You know, whether you're right or wrong, and the thing that comes forward, am I going to get in trouble over this? You know, and it's no way to operate. It really is. You wonder why crime is exploding in New York City, because the cops got pushed back a step to the point where they have to worry about everything that they do. So now, what do you see going forward in Afghanistan with the recently liberated ISIS folk and the Taliban takeover?
You know, everybody's got an opinion, Peter. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. I know that there's been a lot of private military contractors in there, former, you know, special forces operator people, like the Pineapple Express has been talked about. There's some amazing people doing some amazing God's work behind the scenes. I think, more direct to your question, I think it's going to fall into complete chaos. I think we're going to see things, you know, because you have to remember, we didn't always have the internet. Now these people have a newfound. One thing about the mindset of a terrorist, if it bleeds, it leads. So they're masters at propaganda. So anything they can show that harms the U.S. reputation, which to me has been irreparably harmed at this point, at least with this administration. They're going to do it. So every day it's going to be a, can you top this, of insanity and madness and mayhem and cruelty? I mean, it's just, it's really unconscionable what happened there. It really is.
Yeah. Well, I kind of like the messaging that they're putting out. You know, this is the newer kind of Taliban, you know, and it's such nonsense. This is absolute nonsense. Taliban 2.0, as they're calling them, or, it's insane. It was incredibly frustrating to me, you know, just watching what transpired over the last couple of weeks. Didn't have to end like that. The spin that's coming from the media and from the administration is revolting. It really is. Oh, it was a success. We got 120,000 people out. 7,000 of those people were Americans and our Afghan warfighters, our allies on the ground over there. The other 110,000, 113, that's just whatever hoople showed up at the airport that day and says, you know what, we're going to go give it a shot in America. We don't know who these people are. A lot of these people, vast majority, were not vetted. And so you don't know who's going to be coming here. But you abandoned our, you know, when I say allies, I mean all the war fighters within the Afghan army. The Afghan army, people don't realize we're losing 25,000 people a year for the last couple of years fighting. And they fought up until they could. When the rug was yanked out and we walked out of Bagram, that was it. There's no more support coming. There was a story about a group of Afghan special forces soldiers fought to the bitter end in one of the northern provinces. And, they ran out of ammo. That was it. Okay, come on out. We're not going to kill you. All right, just throw your weapons down. Come on out. They were immediately murdered as soon as they came out, 13 or 14 special forces guys. And, and you just look at it. It's just an abomination. I'm sorry I didn't bring this up sooner. Were you guys using the biometric equipment in Iraq when you were there?
Yes. Actually, it was pretty much in its infancy when we got it. And one of the things that's we didn't have the benefit, I'm sure it's changed since then, is that, we didn't have what they call downward telemetry or real time. So in other words, you would use this, they call it the BATS, it's the biometric automated tool set. It's all open source. Anybody wants to Google it. they can have at it. And basically, it takes fingerprints and a retina scan at the same time. And then from that, you would input the person's information. Well, the information was going straight into basically the SIM card or the memory card or whatever that device used. And later, sometime later, transferred into a mainframe database. So at some point in time, and don't quote me on this, I believe the system now is almost the equivalent of being able to do a computer check. In other words, if you actually grab somebody on the battlefield, in theory, and use this machine right there and then, it would spit out his information. So you would know who this person is, provided, of course, he was actually put in to the system. You know, that's the other if. So, but we didn't have that in the beginning. We just had, it was just raw data going in and they were building a database. Now my understanding is, and again, don't quote me on this, that if they've captured somebody on the battlefield or a civilian person that worked with the Colombian forces or the American forces, and their information is put in there, it's all a free-for-all now for the Taliban.
Which I'm sure will be used to identify former members of the military, the police, you know, the local governments. And I have no doubt in my mind they're going to wind up. I mean, you can't go by the news reports we see right now. Some people are saying they're being hunted down. And some people say no, it's a gentler kind. And people don't understand the Taliban. It's kind of like as a group, it's not really linear and cohesive. You have different groups of people in the Taliban. I think a lot of these clowns that we're seeing on the 6 o'clock news every night, 2 weeks ago, this guy might have been a shoe repair man in Kandahar and says, oh, look at this train coming through town. Let me grab an AK. And now I'm going to go, you know, jump on this party that's heading towards Kabul. But the precipitous pullout, we're seeing these same people now outfitted with the best weapons in the world, uniforms. I'm still mind blown by the whole thing, how it collapsed like this. It didn't have to be this way. And I think, as you said, there's going to be a lot of players back in circulation now. I don't know. Like I said, you really have to do your research. They say, oh, the Taliban doesn't get along with Al-Qaeda, you know. Nah, these guys function together. They may have their differences, but they are going to work together to achieve their aims.
Yeah, listen, it's like a three-ring circus. You got the president of the United States, you know, gaslighting the whole country. You got Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense. He's gaslighting the whole country. And you got Mark Milley, who's more concerned about understanding his own white rage and white privilege. I mean, these people are a joke. They are an absolute joke. And I will tell you something. I'm not a violent person. Let me take a step back. I have to be pushed into violence. I could be violent if I had to, like most people. But some of the things that are coming out of their mouths and some of the ways that they have denigrated the service of these kids that just got killed, and I'm only calling them kids because of their age. They're beautiful young men and women that were killed. And that didn't have to be. And when you say, I take responsibility, well, that's great. Because you know what comes after responsibility? Accountability. Get the heck out of office or resign. And if you're not going to resign, let's have some legitimate hearings and start looking into who knew what, when, and where. And what did you say in that conference room with the president? If you said, Mr. President, I think this is a bad idea, and he told you, sit down, I don't want to hear what you have to say, you should stand up as a leader, if you have a spine, and say, I'm not going to do this because the plan is flawed and this is the reasons why. And moreover, I'm not putting my people in harm's way because of your pride and ego. But that apparently didn't happen because nobody resigned. The plan was implemented, if you want to call it a plan, and our kids, our soldiers got killed, our Marines. I'm particularly upset about that. I'm upset at the point where I wrote my local congressman, Ben Klein, and I'm wanting to go to Congress and testify on Capitol Hill and talk about the malfeasance of these people and the disgrace that they brought on this country and their uniform. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, there's a lot of the traditionally, I would say, I don't want to say leftist, I don't want to label anybody, but like the Washington Post, they actually fired a couple of missiles into Biden and the generals lately. And I was kind of surprised because I think now we're seeing a level of lying and incompetence that we just, I mean, it's bad. They released a report last week where the offer was made by the Taliban. You can secure Kabul, hold it, get your people out, then we'll come in. And they turned it down. They offered them the area around the airport to secure it and hold it. They turned them down. I don't know who in the chain of command was. I don't know if it was the ground commander in Iraq. Afghanistan. And he's the guy on the ground over there. See, I really don't want to get into the second guessing game with a guy like him. He's the guy that's boots on the ground on an airfield. But when I see people like General McKenzie from CENTCOM, and he was the first guy up the bat the other day trying to put lipstick on a pig. And I'm looking at this guy and I'm like, bro, you got to be kidding me. I mean, you're trying to come out here and put this. Oh, yeah, it was wonderful. It was a horror show, an absolute debacle. And Austin, I think, is clueless. Biden, you know, he's Joe Biden, you know. And I, you know, as my father used to say 30, 40 years ago, he says, Joe Biden is the dumbest guy in the Senate. And that's decades ago. All right. This man was a moron. I don't want to offend any of our listeners, just my personal opinion. Okay. But some really poor decision making. If you watch the press conference yesterday, he's turning around and throwing this back into the general's laps by saying, hey, I listened to them. You know, so I think Milley and McKenzie and Austin, they're about to get reamed. And I'm sure they know it by now because Biden's blaming them. He's not going to take the heat. On a different note, have you been following the story about Lieutenant Colonel Scheller?
I have been following that.
Enlighten us.
Well, I think this guy had a bird's eye view of what was really going on. I mean, to your point, boots on the ground. I think he had a personal investment, as we all do. First of all, we're all Americans. We're invested. We love the military. We care about our soldiers and people in the military. But I think he had a personal investment in terms of he was involved in some of the training of some of these Marines, unfortunately, that were killed. So it's very personal to him. And I think he spelled it out very clearly that people are just lying. They're flat out lying about the competency. Listen, we're there 20 years. Think about it. 20 years. That means if an Afghan soldier signed up at age 20, he's 40 years old. He should be a general in the Afghan army at this point in time. And to your point, I agree with you. And I understand what you're saying about some of the Afghans actually put up a good fight and they were losing their lives as well. But you can't care more about the project than the owner, meaning that this is your country. Is this what you really want? And apparently they don't really want that. Or the people that are in control of the country, instead of getting rid of them, we allow them to flourish. And I just want to bring up one other point. And I don't want to get too far off topic about the lieutenant colonel, because I salute him. I don't salute the way he went about it, but I'm not him. Okay. I don't know his level of frustration and anger and hurt that he has in his heart for these service people. Okay. So I'm not going to speak to that, but I agree with it. Somebody had to say it. It's unfortunate that his career is now over.
It's over.
Yeah, because he said it. But you know what? I'm sure he's going to land on his feet because he's got what we call a spine. He's a leader of men and women. Okay. But I don't know if you're aware of this because I had to research this myself. They were still growing poppy and heroin in Afghanistan all throughout this 20 years that we were there. And I saw a report with a Marine officer, and he was doing verbal gymnastics about justification of why we let it grow in this province and not let it grow in this province. So again, getting back to the research, Afghanistan is responsible for 90% of all opium production worldwide. So if you really wanted to do nation building and you wanted to change the hearts and minds of these people and introduce a Western type of culture and a democracy, I don't think having a thriving drug trade is the way to go about it. I think some of these interns from your friend's university, Georgetown, that are now part of President Biden's administrative advisors and staff, they don't have a clue about what's going on in geopolitics and moreover in a war zone. They don't have an idea. Their whole world is involved in a 14-inch flat screen. That's their whole world. They've never left the trust fund arms of their parents.
100%. 100%. You know, you talk about the poppies growing heroin. That used to boggle my mind. I know in the first iteration of the Taliban, it was not allowed. But like every other organization, as they mature, you realize, whoa, wait a minute. We're making big money off of this. So, you know, and what when you start looking into the people, like I don't want to blame the Afghan army for their collapse. I want to blame their leadership because there were soldiers out there fighting. But you look at a guy like Hamid Karzai, who was the president of the country. His brother is the biggest opium dealer in Afghanistan. These people became billionaires with this. They became billionaires over looting American aid. You know, shame on us for, you know, getting involved with people like that. They really have no interest in their own government or their own country. They're going to make a buck and they're getting out. Hamid Karzai was actually, I believe, in Doha last week, sitting down with the Taliban leadership.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? You know, I don't know. Maybe sometimes I don't think things through. But you know what? A Hellfire missile right through the window, you all deserve it. End of story. Karzai as well. It's just, I don't know how you fight a war like that. You know, with, like I said, with the heroin, I just don't know. What I saw with, for those listeners out there, Lieutenant Colonel Scheller went on social media the other day. He just had it. And he did about a 4-minute speech. Basically just called out the American military leadership, called out the president. And we all understand that. As cops, if you do that in uniform, you're going to get slammed. And he knew he was going to get slammed. And he says, I no longer trust the leadership here. What's going on? Which he was subsequently relieved of duty 2 o'clock the next afternoon. He's since put another post out. There he is. He put another post out where he actually showed his letter of resignation. And line 3 of the resignation is, basically, I no longer trust the leadership of this country. I understand, you know, there were ways of doing things, but I think just at this point, you know, this guy was still a rising star. I have no doubt he would have had stars on his shoulders in a few years.
No question.
And he said, you know what? Enough. Enough is enough. And, you got these bozos in there, like you said, worrying about critical race theory, carrying on about, you know, who can wear a dress, who can get a sex change in the military. What are we doing here? All right. You know, that's not what you should be worrying about. Your main thrust should be able to defend this country and just carrying on about nonsense because it's the politically correct thing to do right now. I don't know. Each day I just sit here in further amazement with what transpires. But I think we're definitely going to be entering a new threat phase, so to speak. 9/11's coming up. And does the new Taliban 2.0? Well, the Taliban didn't attack us in 2001. It was Al-Qaeda. But they protected Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. But it has now become, you know, I think all the other places that we are fighting in Yemen and in Africa and, you know, places we're combating terrorism, we're really going to have to reshift our focus now because I think the hub, the center is going to be in Afghanistan now with all these different groups. And we have countries that are basically hostile to us, the Pakistanis. Me personally, not the people of Pakistan, but the government, they're evil. They're no good. They were the ones that created the Taliban. They've nurtured them. They funded them. You know,
they protected them.
Yeah.
They would, you know, it's like my explanation of Sadr City. Pakistan was like the equivalent of Sadr City. These murderers would run into Pakistan and, you know, you can't take him out. You're going to have to, you know where he is, you know what restaurant he's at, but you're going to have to leave him alone. You can't do anything.
Yeah.
By the way, Pete, not to interrupt you, we give them billions of dollars a year to be our friends. Billions of dollars, yeah. Not millions, billions of dollars.
I'd give them the old Yiddish phrase, bupkis.
Exactly. But again, you didn't go to Georgetown and study political science. You better be quiet because you don't know what you're talking about, Peter. You're using common sense to a common sense problem, and you're going to get yourself in trouble now.
Yeah, well, I'm also a knuckle dragger. You know, I'm just an old school knuckle dragger. And you know what? Let's face it. 30, 40 years ago, we had common sense solutions to deal with problems on our beat in our sector. They were effective. But you know what? You took care of the problem. And not only have we lost that in policing, we've lost that ability now with our military. And you know, it's just on a side note, I was 15 years old when Saigon fell. And I remember watching this, and I was playing with G.I. Joes when I grew up and everything. And, you know, we grew up on World War II movies. And I'm like, how do we lose? The answer as to why we lost was very complex. There's a lot of moving parts to it, but we lost. And I remember the country at the time, we were just like, ugh, this letdown. And between that, Watergate. Then you get Jimmy Carter as president, and probably a nice guy, but he's a boob. And it just one series of setbacks, and like this national malaise came over us. I would say a national depression, inflation rate, 20%, gas lines. Then the hostages got taken in Tehran, and which we all know in 1980, you know, they did attempt to get the hostages back and ended with a plane crash in the desert, helicopter crash, and soldiers.
I got to stop you real quick. Most people don't, I mean, you're right, 100%, but I want you to just remember this for your audience. The reason why that operation was so ill-advised and ill-devised was that France refused to allow us to fly over their airspace.
Yeah.
So people, again, I know you're a student of history, especially the military history. People be wise to remember that. This is going back to the 70s. That's really not that far, long ago.
No, so, it's not.
So, but anyway, continue your thought. I'm sorry, Peter. I just had to say that.
But it's just this national malaise that, you know, no confidence in ourselves. And if people don't think that that's not going to be coming down the pipe after this. And we have, you know, back then, the big bad guy in the neighborhood was Russia. You know, the big bad guy now is China, and probably the China of today is way more dangerous than the Russians were back then. You know, the Russians had a huge army, and I think even the Russians kind of knew it. If they moved in Europe between NATO, the Americans, Germans, they were going to get shredded. No matter how many tanks you got, if they're pieces of garbage, they're still pieces of garbage. But we have a very dangerous adversary that's going to look to make moves now around the world. And I don't know what the answer is, Chris. I really don't know. And I have absolutely, like Lieutenant Colonel Scheller, I have no faith in Babel and Joe. I don't think he's up to the task. And even more importantly, the people around him are not up to the task. Not much in the way of backbone. And I don't know. I don't know where we go from here, except we're going into some dangerous times.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you, and I am frustrated. And, you know, back to what you said, you know, it's like the cop. The cop wants to do the job, but there's all these other political restraints that have been placed upon him. You know, the military is great at killing people and breaking things. They're great at it. They have the best weaponry, the best trained. But it's almost like, you know, somebody was talking about this the other day on social media. You know, we had the riots up in Washington Heights, and I was a part of that as a cop, as a uniformed cop, and that went on for days. And then finally, somebody flipped the switch and said, "Okay, we're going to take the streets back. We've had enough." And it was done in like 30 minutes. It was done. Anyone that was on the street, they had fair warning. You were either going to jail or you were getting a beating and going to jail. And
yeah, exactly.
So again, getting back to the military, clearly the capabilities of the American military and the will to do what orders and be able to complete the mission is well within their ability. But they're not run by the military anymore. They're run by these people that are looking for the afterlife. Where can I go in terms of politics? Where can I go in terms of tenured professorship at some liberal college? Where can I go in terms of the military defense industry? Where can I go? And that's all they care about. And if they step out of line, they'll be blackballed in Washington, D.C., and all these higher universities of higher education. So, again, they don't care about the soldier. And I'm saying that generically, whether it's the Army or the Marines or the Navy or Air Force. They don't give a flying hoot about those kids. I care about those kids, and you care about those kids. And apparently Lieutenant Colonel Schiller cared about his men and women as well. But we're in a minority because it's easy now to just go along to get along. And you know what? War and policing is sometimes a dirty business. Sometimes there has to be violence committed for the safety and the order of the people that are just trying to live their lives. But that's not what's happening. That's not what's happening.
And the use of force, I always say this, whenever people ask me about, you know, I says, listen, when a police officer uses force, it's never pretty. It wasn't pretty since the 1840s when the first real large organized municipal police department started. It wasn't pretty then. It's not pretty now, except everybody's recording it. It's a part of the job, no matter how you cut it. And the same thing with the military. There are some things that need to be destroyed, and there are people that are going to have to be killed, and that's the end of it.
Right.
You know, and it's like, you know, and that's the whole thing that people can debate for hours on end. You know, it's all hold hands and sing kumbaya. No, let's blast these sons of bitches. Yeah, and just watching the whole thing, the way everything went. And, you know, and then yesterday, I'm a big animal lover. And they're carrying on about some of the, you know, and then you talk about gaslighting and outright lying. The State Department, as well as the Pentagon, says no American military dogs were left at the airbase. Okay. In that sense, it's a correct statement. The dogs belonging to the American military were airlifted out. Okay, but you have 50 or 100 American contracted dogs were left at the airbase. I mean, over the big picture is always going to be about, you know, getting the people out. I understand that. And it's like a really just horrible episode. And people are showing pictures of the dogs. Now they're running loose at the airport. And I'm sure the Taliban are going to kill them. And these are not the kind of dogs that they would like. And it's becoming a major issue because people in this country, you know, like their animals, but they keep lying about it. They lie, and they lie again. You know, it would have been very simple to say, you know what? Maybe we did leave them there. We understand that with some animal groups that wanted the dogs, whatever, but we left them there. Well, the American, yeah, dogs belong to the United States Army. Yeah, they're gone. But we also had an army of private contractors working there for the Americans. And it's getting terrible news play today, and rightfully so. But they lie right to your face.
I worked with these dogs for 15 months, primarily German Shepherds and Belgian Malinois, and they are amazing animals. Like, people have no idea how smart these animals are, how loyal they are, how many lives they've saved, countless lives, bomb detection, finding a bad guy. I mean, like, on and on and on. I'm a softie. I'm a big dog lover. I'm a big animal lover in general. I used to have a lot of problems with some of the things I saw in the police department in terms of the way animals were treated. But this, to me is it should have been, again, where is the spine? Where is the lieutenant of the platoon that says, you know what, we're not leaving these dogs here? No, no, the colonel says you can't put them on the plane. You know what? Tell the colonel to take a nap. They're coming on the plane. We're not leaving them here to starve to death in a cage. We're not doing that. But apparently we are. Again, somebody could tell me to do that, just like in the police department. Listen, I'm giving you a lawful order. Stand 5 feet from that building that's fully engulfed in fire. Boss, I'd like to do that, but it's a little bit dangerous. The building I could catch a fire. I could get hurt. It's got to be a lawful order. Now, is that a lawful order just because I say so, meaning the colonel that says you can't put the dog on the plane? I don't think so. I don't think that's a lawful order. But even if it wasn't, put the dog on the plane. Tell the colonel, yeah, we left him behind. Put him on a plane and put a blanket over the case so he doesn't see it. I mean, for crying out loud.
Barking? What barking? I don't hear any barking.
No, that's a TikTok video, whatever the heck we're talking about today. I mean, I am beyond enraged about that. And again, I get it. People and then animals. I get that. But how much space would 50 dogs take up in comparison to like a Humvee? One Humvee, which they apparently didn't want to take any of them either. So again, I don't understand it. And the other thing that people should understand, as brilliant as these dogs are and as helpful as these dogs are, they cost a lot of money. And not only do they cost a lot of money, they're involved in over a year's worth of training. And then there's follow-on training. So you don't just say, well, I just want another dog and we're just going to buy one off the shelf. And then it doesn't work that way. It's almost like having a partnership and grabbing a rookie versus a 40-year veteran like you. Like there's no comparison between a dog on the shelf and a dog that's been in combat. There's no comparison.
One of the figures I saw, at least for the Army-owned dogs, from purchase to training, it's $283,000 per dog.
That doesn't surprise me, Peter. It doesn't.
And you look at, you know, they're saying, oh, these were rescue strays that were picked up. The video that they put out today was German Shepherds, the Belgian, the Mount Valleys, with heavy-duty collars on them. These were actually service dogs. But it's like everything else. From Biden on down, Secretary of Defense, Chiefs of Staff, everybody lies. They lie right to your face when we have the evidence right there. Like, no, all right. You want to parse your words and play, you know, words with friends, as I call it. That's all well and good. You're a liar. That's it. We're going to call you that.
Right.
It's just a sickening episode at the end of a bad couple of months that just didn't have to be. I don't know. I don't know where we go from here, Chris. I just really don't know. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for coming on today. I hope our viewers out there enjoyed this. Like I said, I'm sitting in for Ed tonight. He'll be back next episode. But again, Chris, thank you. Thank you for your service to the city. Thank you for your service to the country.
Thank you so much, Peter. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
I'll see you out there, Chris.
Yes, sir.
Okay, folks, I hope you enjoyed the show. Listen, when you're watching this on YouTube, click like, click subscribe, share it with your friends. Let's get this around. We're going to be doing a whole bunch of things in the very near future. We're going to be putting different stuff out that I think, you know, especially members of the NYPD, I think you're going to find quite interesting. So thank you, folks. Have a good night.